Without further ado, I'd like to start our session now and introduce to you Catherine Francis, who is a freelance journalist and author on health issues. I'll hand over to you, Catherine.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, thank you for coming along to this first session of the weekend. I'm frankly amazed to see anyone here because I'm usually developing road rage somewhere over in the camping area. And I thought I was going to be talking to three people who know me. So thank you for coming along to this session. First Steps Out of Weight Problems, which is based on my book of the same name, which came out earlier this year. So what I'm going to try and pack into this next hour is a little bit about why and how weight problems develop, how weight gain and weight loss really work, and why weight loss programs often fail. And most importantly, probably for most of you, some genuine and effective ways that you can improve your weight loss, because we hear so many fallacies and myths about how to speed up your weight loss and how to lose 10 pounds in a week. And so I want to talk about some genuine ways to improve your weight loss. So a little bit about me. As Simon said, I'm a journalist for the last 20 years. I mainly work on women's magazines, health magazines, slimming magazines. I've interviewed a lot of experts. I've done a lot of research. I've interviewed a lot of ladies and gentlemen who've lost vast amounts of weight in healthy ways, which is the main thing. But I think there are a few things more annoying than someone who gets up and tells you how to do something they've never had to do themselves, and they've never had to battle themselves. So I have had my own battle with weight, which I'll talk a little bit more about later. So I was asked to do this session as a workshop, so with some interaction, but I'm aware that people will be here in different situations. Some of you may be here because you have a weight problem yourself. Some of you may be here because you're concerned about someone else who's got a weight problem. So I'm going to try and keep it as flexible and as low pressure and as safe as possible. And also I'm aware that weight problems are often quite an emotional area. And the last thing people may want to do is start spilling their guts to someone they've never met before. So I'm just bearing that in mind, that it's going to be very low pressure. So yes, weight problems can be hugely tied up with emotional issues, both in how they develop and how you feel when you've got a weight problem. I think especially for women, although I guess for men as well, how we feel about ourselves is very often closely dovetailed with how we look, and weight plays a massive part in that. Would you agree? Yeah. And it doesn't help that the media constantly badges us to look like stick people, and that there's still it's still kind of acceptable to be quite contemptuous of people who've got a weight problem. In my family, about the worst thing you can say about someone is that they're fat. I can remember watching a news program, say, with their family about someone who'd done some heinous crime, child murder or something, and the worst thing my dad could come up with was, look at that disgusting fat slob. And you think of all the things you could have chosen, all the horrible character features of that person you could have chosen, the worst thing you could think of was to call them fat. So no wonder we're all a bit paranoid about it. And I think often also we feel a sense of failure that we haven't managed to get these problems under control, and it becomes just a vicious circle. So very much tied up with how we feel about ourselves. But weight problems also often develop in conjunction with how we feel about ourselves. I think that's underrated, how often someone's journey of weight is actually a journey of their life and how they've been feeling at that moment. Do people relate to that? And I think that can start at a very early age. Even as children, we often we learn to associate naughty, for want of a better word, foods with treats and rewards. And we will then take that into adulthood and use nice foods to treat ourselves and reward ourselves. I was doing it on the way down here. I hate driving down here. And so every 10 miles, I let myself have a Jelly Baby as a reward for managing to get 10 miles. And I think I'm still doing that. I'm in my 40s and I'm still doing that thing. Stodgy carbs tend to have quite a soporific effect on the brain. So it's a classic comfort food, because if you're feeling very tense and you want to calm down, stodgy foods can help you do that. So we get in the habit of grabbing those comfort foods to make ourselves feel better. And in the opposite way, sugary foods often boost our mood. So when we're feeling low, we grab some chocolate and it gives us a very temporary lift. Very temporary, unfortunately, it plunges down and then, half an hour later, you want some more. So, as I say, I think many people's journey of weight is actually a story of their feelings. So to give myself as a little example, I put on a vast amount of weight during pretty much the worst 2 years of my life, about 12 years ago. My mum had just died. I'd been looking after her for 5 years. She died. I was also trying to care for my great aunt, who was also nearing the end of her life. I was in the most stressful couple of years I'd ever had at work, working incredibly long hours. I wasn't that happy at home. I just felt exhausted. I felt chaotic. I felt unhappy. I felt unloved. And my default way of self-medicating was to turn to comfort foods. And in the space of about 2 years, I put on what I can think everyone will say is fairly impressive, 5 stone in 2 years. And I felt, you know, pretty lousy. I was essentially self-medicating, and I think that's a habit that a lot of us have. At the same time, of course, I had, you know, I was looking after this person, I was trying to do that work. I didn't have time for trying to make nice exercise programs, cook home food. And so the end result was fairly obvious. And I carried that weight for quite a few years until circumstances changed and I was able to get more routine back into my life and I could lose the weight, which I did. I lost that 5 stone again, and in the ways that I'm going to talk about a bit more later. So for me, I definitely know that if my life is disordered, my eating becomes disordered, everything becomes disordered, and that's my weak point. Other people go the other way. I've got a friend who's just had a really tough couple of years, and she's lost so much weight that I'm frightened to hug her now. She's like, I'm going to break her. She's like a twig person. And so people, either one way or the other, often have this very emotional relationship with food. Even in the last year, I've had quite another chaotic and disordered year. It's been a very happy year, but it's been quite chaotic, and hence my lifestyle has become very chaotic, and I've gained a few pounds. And so I know that I need to get that routine back in order to start looking after myself better again. And often it can be, I think, a very fine line between disordered eating and an eating disorder. And often some of us are kind of weaving backwards and forwards across that line. It's quite hard to know where that line is. Now, I'm not qualified to talk about eating disorders. That's a very specialist psychiatric area. But I certainly think for a lot of us, disordered eating is an indication of what's going on in our lives. And unlike other forms of self-medicating, there isn't a lot of sympathy for us, is there? Has anyone read Caitlin Moran's book, How to Be a Woman? No. She's got a whole chapter on attitudes to weight problems. And she has a really interesting take on it that hadn't actually occurred to me before. So I'm just going to read you a quick paragraph and see what you think. She says, by choosing food as your drug, you can still make the packed lunches, do the school run, look after the baby, pop in on your mum, stay up all night with an ill five-year-old. Something that's not an option if you're caning off a gigantic bag of skunk or regularly climbing into the cupboard under the stairs and knocking back quarts of scotch. Overeating is the addiction of choice for carers. And that's why it's come to be regarded as the lowest ranking of all addictions. It's a way of messing yourself up while still remaining fully functional because you have to. Overweight people aren't indulging in the luxury of an addiction that makes them useless or a burden. Instead, they're slowly self-destructing in a way that doesn't inconvenience anyone else. And that's why it's so often a woman's addiction of choice. Does that kind of... what's the word I'm looking for? You know, do you relate to that at all? Does that kind of ring true for you? Yeah, I think so. Of course, this kind of self-medicating pattern that we get into doesn't work for very long. It works in the short term, very, very short term, minutes and hours rather than weeks, months and years. And in the long term, it certainly makes everything harder and more exhausting and just tougher to deal with. There are other reasons why weight problems are on the increase. Some people don't actually have a problem with their weight. They move through life quite happily and it doesn't bother them at all. I think that they're probably in the minority, but there are people like that. But 21st century lifestyles are making weight gain much more likely anyway. And for some people find their weight gain just inexplicable. They can't understand why they've gained this weight. The more sedentary lives that we lead now play their part. We're more sedentary at home, in our leisure, at work, more automated tasks. But also we've got used to bigger portions. In the last 20 or 30 years, the average portion sizes of ready meals and restaurant meals have doubled. In America, they've tripled. And we've become used to seeing portions as normal when actually they're far bigger than we need. We're also busy. We rely more on ready prepared meals rather than cooking ourselves. We tend to graze more and just kind of pick at stuff through the day at our desk. We don't take a lunch break. We graze as we're going. And all those foods tend to be quite high in sugar and fat and salt. So we're more likely to gain weight and also more likely to not feel satisfied for longer and need to reach for the next biscuit more quickly. So it's really not that surprising that there's an increase in weight problems in this country. In addition, we're actually fighting the fact that as mammals, we are programmed to gain weight. As animals, we're programmed to gain weight while we can, eat high fat and high sugar foods while it's available, in order to get us through the famines that may be on the horizon. But in the Western world, we don't have food shortages very often, so we're kind of constantly fighting the fact that the food is always available and the urge is always there to eat it, but the famine never comes. So we end up gaining that weight and keeping it on. And there are lots of other biological reasons why we gain weight as well. Age, changes in metabolism, pregnancy, some medical conditions, some medications. So all those things can play a part in why we gain weight. I really want to get away from this idea that it's because we're greedy and lazy. It really isn't. I hate the guilt and the shame that's attached to weight problems, but unfortunately that is often how we feel. So the first step out of weight problems is to understand why and how we've gained them. And so I'm going to give you a little task to do and just give you a few minutes. I'm going to let people do this in whatever way they want. If you want to get into groups or pairs and chat to each other, or you can do that. Or if you prefer to just work on your own and make a few notes. If you need a pen and paper, Rob here will come around and give you a pencil and paper. So just put your hand up and just spend 2 or 3 minutes thinking about why your weight problem or the weight problem of the person you're concerned about has developed in terms of the lifestyle issues and also the emotional journey that has brought you to where you are. So I'm just going to give you a couple of minutes to do that, and do put your hand up if you want a pencil and paper. Okay. Thank you. So there'll be a chance to chat more later on, but would anyone at this point like to share anything? We've got roving mics if anyone fancies talking a little bit about their own story, but there's no pressure. Yes? No? Yes. Okay. Wait for us, we'll just bring you a mic. Thank you.
I come out of a family where, not a family, my dad had a problem with alcohol, and I think I don't have a problem with alcohol, but I think that's foods, my addiction to comfort when I'm lonely, when I'm bored, or when I'm feeling low. That's my pick-me-up.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
That's me.
I suppose the comfort is that it's healthier than an alcoholic addiction. But yeah, I think a lot of people can relate to that. Is that something that people can relate to a little bit? Yeah. Anyone else want to say anything at this point? Yes?
Yeah, I was involved in a quite traumatic car accident about 20 years ago and put on a colossal amount of weight. I went up to 17 and a half stone. Now, having lost 2.5 stone, I've now completely plateaued for about 2 years and can't shift anymore. I've upped my exercise. Last year I walked a marathon, but I've changed shape, but I don't seem to be able to lose any more weight.
Okay.
And that's what I would like to do.
Okay, well, I might have some more tips for you further on in the seminar which might help you with that, I hope. But well done on losing the 2.5 stone. A lot of people have that plateauing experience, and it's tough. Hopefully I'll have some extra help for you in a moment. Okay, so as if we needed any other reasons to tackle our weight problems, I will give you a few anyway. The self-esteem thing is a given, really, but it's rather terrifying, I found it rather terrifying to discover that obesity is second only to smoking as the top cause of preventable premature death. And we've all learned how dangerous smoking is, and we avoid it if we can. But the number two is obesity, through various reasons. It ups your likelihood of developing heart disease and various cardiovascular diseases. It ups your rate of stroke. It increases your risk of type 2 diabetes, various cancers. And just on a day-to-day level, things like incontinence, infertility, birth complications, mobility, all those things are really very much affected by the extra weight you carry. Even if you're not obese, they can make life more difficult to just move through. I found that myself. Certainly, it also being overweight will also increase your likelihood of having osteoarthritis later in life and having to have a hip or knee replacement. And just in day-to-day life, better energy, better sleep, better libido, all those things will respond. And actually, you only have to lose a relatively small amount of weight to see a difference in those things. So it really is worth tackling it. Now, how much weight do we need to lose to be in a healthy weight range? That can be quite hard to tell, because think often also we're programmed, we're being projected with completely unrealistic images of what's a normal healthy body. And often those images that you will see in magazines are not healthy at all, they're underweight. So we have, as well as the fact that we're developing as a nation weight problems, we've also got this very skewed idea of what's normal and what's healthy. And actually the healthy weight range for each person's height is surprisingly wide, depending on your frame and so on. So I think for people who are worried about their weight, the first thing to do is find out how much weight you need to lose. Now, there are BMI, the body mass index calculators on the internet. There's graphs in the book that I've done. So you can find out how much you actually need to lose. And some people may not need to lose any at all because they've got that skewed image of what's normal. And again, if you feel compelled to lose weight when actually you're within a healthy weight range, then I think, again, we're possibly slipping over into eating disorders, body dysmorphia, and that whole other very serious area. So how does weight loss and weight gain really work? If you walk into your local bookshop and look at the diet section, it seems that everyone has discovered the secret. It's only eating a certain food group, or only eating a certain food, or only eating at certain times of the day, or not eating certain foods after certain times of the day, or eating according to your blood group. It's a massive business. Weight loss is a huge multi-million pound business with slimming clubs and meal replacements and of course all the books. The bad news is there is no magic bullet. All of these plans essentially boil down to the same thing, which is energy in versus energy out, and it's really rather boring. And I really wish I could come to you with the magic bullet, but there isn't one, and that's the truth. So the equation simply is, if you take in more energy, which is measured in calories, through the food and drink that you consume, more than the energy that you burn out during your normal bodily functions and daily activity and exercise, then you will gain the extra, you will store the extra calories as fat for the future famine. If you burn more than you take in, the weight will slowly be whittled away. And that, it really is that simple, unfortunately. Gutting, isn't it? It is that simple. It's not that easy. It certainly isn't easy because, you're fighting your body's natural inclination to hold on to weight pretty hard. So I think everyone in this room probably knows that it's an awful lot easier to gain 5 pounds than it is to lose 5 pounds. It's effortless to gain 5 pounds. I could do it by next week without any effort at all. Losing it's another matter. It is really, really tough, but it can be done. I'm proof that it can be done, and there are some things that can help. Now, what would people say is the biggest mistake people make when they embark on a weight loss plan? Crash dieting. It's the worst mistake you can possibly make, and it's so tempting, isn't it? You think, oh, you know, this time next month I could be stone lighter if I don't eat anything. How many people here have crash dieted or yo-yo dieted in the past? Yeah. How many people have ended up heavier than they were before? It's almost inevitable. And again, we're back to this thing about, well, the way your body works in terms of starvation mode. So essentially what will happen when you crash diet is if you eat below, your body needs a certain number of calories a day to function and to function healthily. So for women, that's about 1,200 calories a day. For men, it's about 1,500. If you dip below that, your body essentially says, that famine's arrived. That famine we've been waiting for, it's here. We don't know how long it's going to last. So your body will lower your metabolism in order to try and make the fat stores that you've got last as long as possible. Your metabolism is the rate at which your body is naturally burning energy, whether you're at rest or whether you're exercising, like the revs on a car. And it will automatically lower your metabolism to try and get you through the hard times. Now, a crash diet is not sustainable. No one can keep on it for very long, because you end up with headaches and dizziness and you're more prone to injury and you just feel lousy and it's just impossible. So then you go back to normal by which point your metabolism has been lowered. And so when you start eating normally again, the weight will go on even faster because your metabolism has been lowered. So that's why you end up heavier than you started before. Does that make sense? Yeah. And in any case, it's just not healthy. You need a certain number of calories to get the nutrients you need to keep your body healthy. So exchanging one health problem for another, it's not a great deal, really, is it? Slow but steady wins the race. And it really does. It's not what we want to hear, but it really does. And in my case, it took me about a year and a half to lose the 5 stone that I gained. And that's a rate of about 1 to 2 pounds a week. And that's the recommended amount. If you lose more than that, you're kind of getting into dangerous territory. You will probably lose more than that in the first week or two. But after that, 1 to 2 pounds is the healthy amount to lose. And it will make you more likely to keep that weight off in the long term. There are lots of other reasons why diets fail. Taking that all or nothing approach, I've eaten one biscuit, I might as well eat the packet. I think that's a personality thing as well. I don't know. I mean, I'm a bit of an all or nothing person in life. Either it's, you know, just do it properly or don't do it at all. So you slip off the wagon once, you just think, oh, well, what's the point now? Not having that really clear plan or clear goal. When you're trying to create new habits in your life, if you just kind of wander into it in a very disordered way, I think it's impossible to establish healthy new habits like that. So for me, certainly, and for most people that I've interviewed, having a very clear plan about what they will eat, planning their diet, planning their exercise, putting things in the diary, their exercise schedules in the diary so they can't think, well, I don't feel like it today. And using various techniques to stick to that. It's very easy to get bored with the whole diet and exercise thing and lose motivation. So there are lots of reasons why we tend to fall off the wagon. So I'm going to give you another couple of minutes just to write down or discuss in whatever way you want how weight loss plans for you have failed in the past and why you think they have failed in the past. What has been your tripping point? So I'll give you a couple of minutes. Okay, thank you. So would anyone like to share anything with everybody else about why they feel weight loss plans might have failed in the past? Yes, thank you.
I've had a couple of female friends over the years who've tried many different miraculous diets, such as Lighter Life, and I think the biggest failure point for some of these is that they're over-marketed. They're shoved in your face as being fantastic, but I think they don't always address some of the psychological issues or childhood issues that have come through with that. And I think where they've seen the success initially with some of these diets where you're losing lots and lots of pounds, you know, week after week, it looks fantastic, it feels fantastic, but as soon as you then step away from that diet and try and return back to what we would consider a normal everyday life, they haven't addressed the issues such as, I'll eat one biscuit, I might as well have the rest of the packet. They haven't actually addressed those issues, so that's where I think the failure point lies with some of these diets.
Yeah, brilliant. Thank you. That's my phone that's making that noise. Lighter Life, for people who don't know, is one of these meal replacement plans, aren't they? And I'm being recorded, so I'll be careful what I say in terms of legals. But certainly one of the main problems with these meal replacement plans, various kinds, is that they don't re-educate you in any way. So you can kind of switch from one slightly obsessive way of eating to another slightly obsessive way of eating. And when you get where you're trying to be, you haven't learned a new lifestyle. And if you carry on doing what you did before, you'll get the same results. So people often will lose quite impressive amounts of weight in quite short amounts of time, and then it all goes straight back on again. So, yeah, they haven't kind of tackled the root issue. They haven't changed their lifestyle because it has to be a permanent lifestyle change. Otherwise, if you keep doing the same thing, you keep getting the same result. And I think that's experience for an awful lot of people as well, is that they lose weight and lose quite large amounts of weight and then are gutted because they've put it all back on again. And some people will do that over and over again, over, you know, decades. They'll lose 5 stone, gain 5 stone, lose 6 stone, and it's that problem exactly. Yeah. Anyone else? Yeah.
I have body dysmorphia, if you like, the other way around. I wasn't a fat baby, I wasn't a fat child, I wasn't a fat teenager, I wasn't actually fat until I got pregnant. And so I never think of myself as fat, which is quite a real problem.
Well, it's a blessing in some ways, and it's a problem in other ways. And I think sometimes it can work the other way. People who've lost lots of weight can't actually lose that sense that they are overweight and they aren't happy with how they look. I'm not sure what I'd say to you, really. I wouldn't want you to feel lousy about yourself. I'm pleased that you sort of still see yourself as you've always been. But I suppose it doesn't give you much motivation to improve your health. Is that what you're saying?
30 years.
So. Yeah. Okay. Anyone else? Yeah, this lady down the front here.
I think it's very hard to diet if you've got a family, if you've got children. You don't want to sort of, cause any problems with them. So that's what I find it very difficult to diet and try and with the portion size.
Yeah.
You know, you're doling out the pie, the family. From the pot, and I've got my younger children. I've still got the younger ones are still at school, so I've got like a rugby playing boy, obviously, and then my daughter, who's actually 2 years older, she is a bit overweight. But it's then, should she get less and he get more?
Yeah,
without actually wanting to, set any problems for them.
Yeah, it's a very difficult
one. I find that
very
hard.
Yeah, I think a lot of mums, especially who are dieting, desperately don't want to. infect their kids, for want of a better word, with this obsession of how they look and how they ought to look, and then when you get children developing eating disorders because from the age of zero they've heard their mums kind of paranoid about eating 10 extra calories that day. So yeah, it can be a real dilemma. I mean, I don't have children, so I've not had that sort of dilemma, but I think often the advice is to cook the normal meals but in a much healthier way. There are cookbooks that will show you how to do low-fat versions of your normal family meals, and to try and encourage more exercise as a family without saying we're going out now to try and burn some calories off, but going for family walks, going for playing cricket in the park, those sorts of things. Portion sizes, yeah, I'm not sure how you handle that, especially with the age thing as well. I suppose, yeah, I don't know, does anyone have any suggestions for that? Yeah, it's a tricky one, isn't it? I don't have a good answer for that, I'm afraid. Okay, so when it comes to weight loss, weight problems can also mean being underweight, but for most of us they mean being overweight. And I do spell out in the book kind of how it really, the full program, as it were, though it's not a diet book as such. But here, I've just got time. I want to give you a few top tips. Now, earlier I said there is no secret magic bullet for weight loss, but there are a few things that can genuinely improve your weight loss, and I hope that will help the lady over there who's plateauing. So I'll just give you these, and these are the ones you might want to take notes of. So a few tips in terms of exercise. Now, obviously, we all know that exercise makes all the difference to weight loss. If you are immobile or disabled and you can't exercise, you can still lose weight, but it's a whole lot harder, because exercise, as we were talking about before, raises your metabolism and just keeps everything chugging along in a much more healthy way. Burns calories while you're exercising, but also improves your metabolism for the rest of your day. But if the thought of getting your body into Lycra and bouncing around in front of a mirror, in front of a room full of other hard-bodied cows, strikes the fear of God into you, then rest assured, it doesn't have to be anything like that. You can do whatever you like that you enjoy, that you will stick to, and that raises your heart rate for 30 minutes, 3 or 4 times a week. It can be dancing, it can be cycling, it can be martial arts, it can be hill walking, tennis, swimming, cycling, ice skating, anything that you will actually enjoy, which is the main thing, otherwise you won't stick to it if you don't enjoy it, and can do on a regular basis. And sometimes it's about knowing your lifestyle and what works for you and what kind of personality you are. So for me, I knew that if I had to come home from work, get my gear on, schlep down to the gym in the dark, have all that messing around, I knew I wouldn't keep it up for very long. So what worked for me was having an exercise bike at home. Now, I know I'm probably one of the few people who owns an exercise bike that is used for anything other than a clothes horse. Although Rob might say that I do use it as a clothes horse at the moment. But it really worked for me because I could just jump on it for a half an hour, an hour. I watched videos while I was doing it to relieve the boredom. I could leap off in the shower and it was all done. And that worked for me. And also, I'm someone who likes to see measurable change. So I liked to see exactly how fast I was cycling, for how long, in what space of time. I'd keep little charts. That worked for me because I'm that kind of personality. Other people want it to be something sociable. So they will go to an aerobics class with their friends and have a bit of a laugh and make something fun out of it. And that, if that's what works for you, then that's great. So these are my hot tips for exercise. Has anyone heard of interval training? Interval training is it's proven to burn fat more effectively than any other type of exercise, and you can apply it to any exercise. So it's a technique that you can apply to any exercise. And all interval training is alternating between going at your absolute maximum that you can manage and taking a nice leisurely period in between. So, for instance, me on the bike, I'd be cycling like mad at 20 kilometres an hour for 5 minutes if I could manage it until I felt like my heart was going to burst out my chest. Then I'd do 5 minutes at a nice leisurely 10 kilometres an hour. And for some reason, we're not quite sure why, it may just be because you can maintain it for longer, but for some reason this technique burns calories faster than any other, faster than if you're going at a moderate speed for the same. So if you're interval training for an hour, you will burn a lot more than if you are going at a moderate pace for an hour. Does that make sense? Yeah. And even if you're going at a fast pace for an hour, because you can't really maintain that for very long. So we do know that that is a very effective way of burning fat more effectively. So I recommend that one as a hot one. The second technique is resistance training, which again is a fancy word, but all it means is building muscle density through resistance work. So that could be resisting against weights. That could be resisting against your own body weight, so press-ups and so on. It could be resisting against water. It's anything that you have to work against to work those muscles and build your muscle density. And the reason that makes such a difference is we're back to that old metabolism thing again. Muscle burns calories at a higher rate than any other body tissue. So the more dense your muscles, the more calories your body will be burning an hour, even if you're asleep. I like the idea of burning more calories while I'm asleep. That works for me. So that's another top tip. Now, often at this point, women will say, well, I don't want to end up looking like a muscle-bound man. You know, I don't want to end up looking like a bodybuilder. You won't. It's virtually impossible. Bodybuilding work takes serious dedication and hard work, and it's almost a full-time job. So you won't end up looking like a man. You won't end up looking muscle-bound, but you will have toner, denser muscles, and that will improve your ongoing weight loss, whether you're actually exercising at that point or not. And also, it's just a case of looking for ways to be more active in general life. I think we've probably read it a million times in women's magazines. Walk instead of taking the bus, take the stairs instead of the lift, all those things. Constantly be looking for little ways to just build more activity into your general life so that you're just moving around more. Because we're all so static, aren't we? I spend all day crouched in front of a computer at work. I take the train home. I barely move. You know, you kind of have to look for ways to incorporate that more. So, easily said. Not so easily done, necessarily. In terms of eating, I would say it really is a case of, not a case of eating less, but a case of eating smarter. When I gained that huge amount of weight, it wasn't actually that I was eating vast volumes of food. It was that I was eating all the wrong foods. I was grabbing the chocolate from the machine at work when I was stuck there at 10 o'clock at night, and I was eating the puddings because it made me feel better because I missed my mum who just died. You know, all those kind of eating the wrong foods. And I was kind of bewildered by how I managed to put the weight on myself just because I wasn't actually eating huge volumes, you know? Did people relate to that a little bit? Yeah. So top tips for eating in terms of healthier cooking methods and just a healthier diet, those are the things that you can find in lots of different books. But tip number one, don't miss breakfast. Breakfast can often seem like an easy meal of the day to miss, but the research is that if people who eat breakfast every day are many times less likely to have a weight problem than people who miss breakfast on a regular basis. And again, it's down to the old metabolism thing. During the night, your body will lower your metabolism slightly to get you through the night, and in the morning you have to break the fast, breakfast, to give your metabolism that little boost again and get things chugging along for the day. So that's top tip number one. Eat little and often. I know we were talking earlier on about grazing and that bad habit we have of grazing, which I'm not talking about. I'm talking about three healthy meals and three healthy snacks a day, not going for more than about 3 hours without eating. And again, it just keeps your metabolism chugging along in a very healthy way. But do choose what you eat carefully. Are people aware of glycemic index of foods? Is this a term that you're familiar with? Yeah? For those who don't know, the glycemic index of every food has a certain glycemic index, and it is to do with how quickly your body breaks down the carbohydrates and releases the sugars into your bloodstream. So high glycemic, high GI foods like sugary snacks, refined carbohydrates will release sugars very quickly, and you will get an instant energy lift, and you'll feel good, and then that peak will trough very quickly, you know, within an hour, and you will feel worse than you did before, and you won't feel full, and you'll want to reach for the next snack. Whereas low GI foods will release a steady supply of energy that will last longer, that will keep your blood sugar level instead of up and down the whole time, and you'll feel fuller for longer as well. So you'll be able to, you know, a good, healthy, low GI breakfast will sustain you through for lunch, and you won't be wanting to go to the chocolate machine at 11 o'clock as much as you would if you'd eaten a high GI breakfast. Does that make sense? Yeah. So low GI foods are things like whole grain cereals, brown bread, brown rice, brown pasta, porridge, oats, most vegetables. And you can find GI books that will give you the listing of every food and which ones are the ones that to choose that will make it, frankly, easier not to overeat. So those books are available. And in my book, I also give lots of information on food swaps and meal suggestions and tips for negotiating parties and weddings and events out, nights out, cooking methods, all that kind of stuff. So other little tips. How are we doing for time? Not too bad. Get more sleep. It's surprising that the research is that people who are sleep deprived are 73% more likely to have a weight problem than people who get plenty of sleep. And the reason for that is that we have hormones called leptin and ghrelin in our bodies, and these control they control how full you feel, and they control they trigger hunger. So these hormones are having quite a strong influence on how much you want to eat and what kind of foods you want to eat, and they get disrupted. If you don't have enough sleep, those hormones will get disrupted, and so you're more likely to crave those high sugar energy boosts during the day. And there's also some evidence, although it's kind of not really well researched yet, but that if those hormones are disrupted, your body's more likely to burn muscle rather than fat. When it does want to burn energy, it will take it from the wrong place. And the other thing is, easier said than done, stress levels. Now, cortisol is the stress hormone, and the more stressed you are, the more likely you are to have high levels of cortisone. And again, this gives you an urge to eat, and it also increases your insulin production and messes with your sugar levels a bit. And there's also evidence to show that the higher your cortisol levels, the more likely you are to store fat around your middle. And if you know anything about male and female shape, you know the reason that men are more likely to have heart problems is because they're more likely to store their fat around the middle. And that is associated with cardiovascular problems. But women can also store that fat around the middle, and stress is more likely to do that. Not so easy to just lower your stress levels, though, is it? Yeah. So I want to, what little time we've got left, I would really like to hand over to you, really, and ask if you have any more you'd like to say about your own weight struggle, how it's developed, what has worked for you, what definitely hasn't worked for you, and any helpful tips you might have for anyone else. So would anyone like to contribute? This lady down the front.
I've associated with a lot of the things you've said in terms of your personality. So I was just wondering what resistance training you'd found was useful.
Okay. Well, I kind of doubled up a bit because I was using an exercise bike a lot. If you use higher gears, you're also increasing your resistance. So kind of lower half, I went up and down the gears. So I'd either go very, very fast, very, very slow, or I'd work up and down the gears while staring at sitcoms to relieve the boredom of pedaling. And so that was the resistance on the lower half. On the upper half, I just used some cheap hand weights and just did a few basic moves that I've learned from aerobics classes over the years to work on my upper body. My arms are never going to be strong. They're always a bit weedy, but it helped. Yeah. Okay.
What about sugar? I mean, it seems to me that a lot of low-fat products seem to have a lot of sugar in them, and you've mentioned the glycemic index, and it seems to me that often a lot of the weight loss programs, it's about low fat, but I don't know whether that is really a good thing. If you there's going to be a lot of sugar and salt to try and, I don't know. I mean, I tried cutting out sugar, and I think for me the weight loss didn't happen because of two big portions still. But I actually think I was less inclined to eat, to binge maybe, because I wasn't eating the sugar, and that seems like a good thing, whereas the low fat food seems to have a lot of sugar and salt, and I don't know that that's a good thing. What are your comments?
No, I think you're right. I think be very suspicious of food labels that say healthy and low fat, because what often happens is when products have the fat removed, in order to compensate for the loss of flavour, there will be added sugar. So you're thinking, oh, fantastic, 2% fat, and you don't realise that actually the sugar levels are really high. And that kind of peaking and troughing thing with sugar is very addictive, and it screws with your mind and it screws with your body. And so you're absolutely right. So I would say to people, be suspicious of food labelling, and have a look at the proper labels yourself and make decisions. And essentially, the less pre-prepared food you eat and the more you make your own food, the healthier you will be. That isn't always practical, but there are ways of doing it. So I cook lots at the weekend and freeze it for the week, because I haven't got time for cooking during the week. There's barely time to sleep. So be suspicious of food labels. Do your research yourself, and be wise, and don't be too fooled by the low fat labels.
You may have already addressed this. I came late and will have to leave directly after this again. I'm wondering more about psychological and habitual eating, whether maybe when you have three good meals a day or eating healthy or whatever, that's one thing, but the habit of binge eating, or just the mind space that you can get into when you start to eat. Do you have any response to how to deal with just that space that your mind might go into that makes you overeat, even if you are eating healthily or at regular times in the day?
Yeah, thank you for that. We did talk about that quite a lot at the beginning in terms of sort of disordered eating. And it's a really difficult one, isn't it? I think everyone sort of struggles because we're all... Disordered eating, for most of us, comes from different sources. And unfortunately... I think it's a process of getting to know yourself and what your triggers are. I agree. Disordered eating is kind of at the root of most weight problems, and it's a tough one. I think that's why so many people are struggling. Yeah. Does anyone else have any tips on that? For me, it was just about getting more order into my life, getting more routine, having a better plan. Not doing things on the fly, so that helped me a lot. But also, it's just becoming slightly happier for various reasons. And anyone else got any comments? Yep, there's a lady at the back. Oh, which way are we going? Thank you.
Our 5-year-old's just had her weight check thing at school, weight and height, and it's come back to say that she's overweight by a fair bit. And obviously, I want to change that, and I want to do the best for her. And she really likes her food, which until this point we've been, oh, that's a really good thing, because she's not a fussy eater so much. But now, obviously, we need to work out what we want to do, and we want to try and give her more exercise. But she does run around a lot anyway. And I think what you were saying about not necessarily cutting back on how much she eats necessarily, but what she eats, but just any useful kind of starting points for a 5-year-old who... doesn't really want her little life to be turned upside down.
Yeah, it's really, really difficult with kids, isn't it? And the weight issue is becoming more and more of an issue with children. And the last thing you want to do is make her paranoid about her weight, because you could be triggering something that's going to be a lifelong battle then for her. So I really appreciate that. I think, again, it's about sort of smart eating rather than eating less. Trying to introduce her to... it's so easy for me to say these things, but introducing her to more vegetables and more fruits and sort of sneaking those into her diet in a way that she's not going to thinking, oh, why have I got this plate of green stuff, and where's the nice lasagna I had last week? Sort of sneaking those foods in, making smoothies and ice lollies out of pureed fruit, those sort of things that look like treats that she would all enjoy anyway, but that just increase. It's not that she has to not have any treats as well. I think the rule for all of us actually is don't cut out every treat, because life's miserable then, isn't it? Eat first what you should and then what you would. Fill up on the good stuff and then you can have treats afterwards, and maybe you can kind of pursue that a little bit. And obviously the more she's exercising, the better. I think my understanding is, I'm not a doctor or anything, but my understanding is with kids, you don't really want to be cutting back massively on their calorie intake, but you do want to be increasing their energy and just getting them burning it off like mad. Does that help at all? Yeah, thanks. Anything else? Anyone else? Or should we wrap up? So, thank you very much. Have a great festival and good health to you all.